Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's first Friday Toast to the Arts and Park Show. And every first Friday, Nancy and I get the awesome privilege of interviewing artists in residence who spend a full month in a national park unit. This is all through the National Parks Arts Foundation. And I mean, these are just incredible opportunities for artists, musicians, writers, poets, singers, songwriters, filmmakers, you name it. If you're in the arts and you want to be in a national park unit, check out their website, nationalparksartsfoundation.org. And hey, you can donate to them too. All right. So today we're excited. We have award-winning freelance writer, journalist, and author Zoe Schlanger joining us. And Zoe's work is incredible. I encourage you to go to her website at zoeschlanger.com. And that's S-C-H-L-A-N-G-E-R. You know, I have to prove that I can spell sometimes. But anyway, go to her website because you'll see all of this work she's done, been on so many newscasts, and she's been, you know, staff writer for Newsweek and many awards, and also writing her book that's coming out in 2023 through HarperCollins. It's called The Light Eaters. And she does a lot of work in regards to writing about plants and ecosystems and people in those ecosystems and the habitats. So very excited because today we're recording on our last day in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Yes. And so welcome, Zoe. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm doing great. What a fabulous intro. I appreciate that.
I had things written down, but I'm like, yeah, but you've done so much. Everyone go to your website.
Because, I know. It's awesome. I was just
all these awards, but you seem to do a lot of travel and work with a lot of different organizations. Mm-hmm. And it's cool that you're with the National Parks Arts Foundation. What got you inspired to even apply for the residency? Because I think it's interesting. We're getting a lot more plant people in Hawaii recently.
Oh, that makes total sense. I mean, I have been working on this book about plant behavior, and Hawaii is such an amazing place to think about that. You know, it's absolutely near impossible that any plant ended up here at all. And so to come to a place where, you know, a single seed had to float across 10,000 miles of the Pacific to end up on an island and then create other and survive on like a rocky island and create other species. You look at every plant here and it feels like it's gone on this remarkable journey. And it, from a biological, like evolutionary standpoint, they created really bizarre, really unique species that are now extremely threatened. So it felt like it would be the best possible place I could go to go look at what it looks like when plants are allowed to evolve without, essentially the species that end up here or ended up being made here are bizarre in part because they mostly don't have any defenses. There was no mammals that ever made it to Hawaii except for a tiny little bat that like blew over in a windstorm somehow. But when, you know, my book is a lot about how plants have adapted to their environments and have learned to live with a lot of threats and have produced really complicated behaviors because of it. But in Hawaii, that's not the case. They got to do basically whatever they wanted. So you have
it's island life,
really
man.
Unique species. Yeah, exactly. And that's what made me want to apply here. I had previously done a fellowship at the National Tropical Botanical Garden on Kauai. They have an environmental journalism fellowship, and that changed my life and got me set on. I was covering climate change before, and now I'm mostly covering plants and botany, thanks to them for the most part. So I want to come back.
But it's so related. I mean, you can't talk about climate change without talking about plants.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Especially, losing species and watching species try and like climb uphill essentially to escape warmer temperatures at lower latitudes. Yeah, all of those things. Absolutely true. Losing your pollinators.
Have you been to Great Basin National Park?
I haven't.
Yeah, because of the trees there, that's like they're ancient and how they change as they go up in the elevation. And that's a really good indicator of what's going on with climate change. And at the same time, we could mitigate climate change if we planted more trees.
Absolutely.
You know, it's kind of this, we've got to look at plants more. I know we've done so many radio shows on wildlife and conservation, and it's always, you know, beating the drum for the animals, which we're 100% there. But I always kept going, gosh, I'm telling you, we've got to look at the habitat. What's going on with the habitat? Because if the habitat and the vegetation is not there, then the animals are not going to survive. You know, they have.
It's true.
There's also seems to be thievery in plants. Have you?
Yes. Yeah. I actually was just visiting the seed bank and the nursery here and talking to the botanists who work at the Volcanoes National Park nursery. And the person, the botanist there showed me a little slide full of orchid spores. And this was the remaining, basically there's one of this orchid left in the wild. Oh. And these were the spores they were trying to cultivate into plants to grow them out in the greenhouse and hopefully outplant them. And I asked her if like the location of that orchid, that last orchid, was a secret. She's like, oh yeah, like the first thing they tell you when you come to work here is you have to turn your location services off on your phone. You are not allowed to post to social media. It's like a very, you know, it's when a plant is that rare, poaching is very serious. They apparently also just had a sandalwood tree poached from inside the park. Someone cut it down, cut it into small enough pieces and shoved it under a fence. And so absolutely thievery, plant poaching all over the place. I know in the West Coast, like in California and also in Utah and places like that, there's been a lot of succulent poaching, like tiny, these like rare succulents are very highly prized in the black market.
Yeah, the Encinitas Botanic Garden in San Diego, they were a small botanic garden, but they made national headlines and actually, you know, they're actually thriving because of this. Everybody knew about them being in the backyard because somebody stole a barrel cactus that's very rare. This whole plant poaching thing becomes like, oh my gosh, there's thievery going on. And when you think about like going to the national parks and seeing some of these plants, like even, you know, orchids, there's orchid thieves, you know, there really are. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And then Everglades, when we're seeing bromeliads up in the trees growing wild, I was like, that's so cool, you know.
Definitely.
So any specific plant species that you met with during your month-long residency? I mean, that is so cool that you get a full month too.
There's so many. I mean, there's some incredible ones. I mean, the main one to talk about here is the ohia tree, which is the keystone species for particularly on the Big Island, but that's on all the Hawaiian Islands. It's this incredible tree. It's the first thing to come out of lava fields. So it's one of these things that has incredible roots that fissure the rock and create places for water to fall in. And you go out to these, you can hear, it's amazing. You can walk on dried lava lakes. It's just an alien landscape. And the thing coming out are little ferns and then also ohia lehua trees. And they have these beautiful red spiky flowers. And it features super heavily. And, you know, it's really important for Native Hawaiian culture and tradition. And it's also this nurse plant. So in a fully native forest, I got to go actually walk into like a wet forest that is 100% native, which is really rare here. It is just, there's zillions of other plants growing on it as it's growing. It's like the biggest tree in the landscape. And there's just, it's just, the bark is covered in all these kinds of ferns. Ooh, and there's like lilies growing out of the branches. You know, there's this species of, the mint here doesn't have mint oil because it dropped its defenses when it arrived here. Like I said before, like anything that serves to deter predators basically got dropped. So there's all these like climbing mints on it. And it's just an incredible
So the mint scent tree. Is actually out of like, don't eat me.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're a rare animal that likes things like pepper or mint oil or, you know, and mustard oil. These are all
so if you start singing to your, and you know how to sing, singing to your mint plant, it might actually say, okay, that's it. If you like talk real nice to it and meditate with it, it might just say, that's it. You know, I'll be your friend. I'm not going to, you know, give you mint oil, but I'll be friends now and chill out.
No, it's more of an evolutionary time scale type thing. But, you know, maybe over generations, if you protect.
But that's so neat though.
When you think they would have about to create a new species. But yeah.
When we lived in Kenya, we learned that what they classified as browsers in the mammal species were animals that would just take the tiny tip of a leaf and then move on and move on and move on. And so I thought, okay, well, that's because it wants to make sure that it doesn't eat the whole plant and then there's nothing to eat the next day. But we were told that the leaf at a certain point would emit either a really bitter taste or a smell. So the browser knows, oh, move on. So the plant could protect itself. And you think, well, it's really hard to say, okay, well, that is a non-thinking living thing. So I've always felt like plants have to have some sort of brains. Not everything's automatic defense. But then I know science will say, no, it's automatic defense. And they were just made that way. And I don't know. I think they think.
Yeah. You know? Well, this is, you've just touched on the biggest debate in botany right now.
I know.
That is, it is really a curious debate right now inside bot. And that's what this book I'm trying to write is about. It's fascinating. It's, I mean, I think the most interesting thing about that conversation is in part, there is no definition for, let's say, consciousness. Is not a, it's not a scientific, there's no agreed upon definition for consciousness, neither for intelligence. And when it comes to plants, they are doing certain things and we're more aware of them now than ever because of like advances in scientific instrumentation, the genomics revolution, everything. You see plants making choices, like they are reacting in real time to threats, to, you know, they're able to sense whether they're planted. Many species can sense if they're planted beside their genetic kin or not, and then like adjust their behavior accordingly. Not to compete with them or to protect them. You know, all these like learning behaviors, all of these things. But then, you know, most researchers are willing to only go so far when you're talking about that, which when you're talking about institutionalized science, it sort of makes sense. The sciences are conservative when it comes to those things for a reason. They don't want to inflate something and then it turned out not to be true later on. But it is, we're right at this tipping edge, I think, where those questions are being asked. Is it right to think of plants as passive? Are they actually actively learning? Are they actually potentially thinking? How are they doing that if there isn't actually a brain organ in the plant? Yeah. This brings up conversations about like what a nervous system really is as well. Plants are electrical beings, a lot like us. Like, there is electricity streaming through them. And so there's tons of papers now with titles like, should we update the definition of a nervous system to include something that doesn't have a brain, you know? So yeah, it's fascinating.
Sometimes it's not just the brain is like being the head on your shoulders. It's part of being, I mean, our brains are still in our cells. You know what I mean? We still have those bits. So I wonder about that in the plant, like if they're, brains are in a cell.
There's all these different ways that it could be happening, and it's so outside of our ability to sort of conceptualize from a human-centric point of view. I mean, you mentioned fungi before. That's also like a case of like a distributed network that is clearly making choices, and it's hard to determine whether or not that should be considered, like, is network intelligence the same as regular intelligence? Is
The first Facebook was fungus.
Yeah, but have you read The Secret Life of Plants?
My favorite.
Have you heard of that book?
I have, and I pitched my book as a update to it.
Cool.
You know, that book really did some damage, like very serious damage to the field of botany. It actually was responsible in part. Basically, it was the first time, you know, 1973, I believe, like the first time popular culture was gripped with plant, like the topic of plants being intelligent beings became like a phenomenon. I mean, Stevie Wonder like wrote an album about it.
The Day of the Triffids.
The Triffids.
Right, exactly. I mean, it sparked a total renaissance in thinking about this in popular culture. And unfortunately, most of the book was not able to be replicated scientifically. And it really scared off a lot of people. I mean, in the sciences from continuing that work because they would be labeled as quacks or like, you know, the funding agencies that give funding, like the national agency that gives funding to research, became very skittish around giving any funding to anyone studying anything close to plant behavior for like 30 years.
Wow.
So
that's a little much.
In some ways, it is coming back now because some of the science is just, first of all, we're far enough away from the secret life of plants, but also some of the science is able to be so much more precise because of modern technology that it's proving some things. Like, that book is the reason people sing to their plants or like think that talking to their plants will help
them. To their plant,
There's no evidence that that is true. However, now, just recently, there's all this upwelling of research around plant acoustics and the fact that they do respond to sounds. They don't respond to like, there's no way to say that they like certain music more than others, because music is not something they would have evolutionarily had to be adapted to. But relevant sounds, like the sound of a bee buzzing, a flower produce sweeter nectar. You know, they are listening. They can hear.
So it's like if it's a forest plant and you play forest noises, that it's going to perk up and go, ooh.
But maybe. Yeah. That's been studied, but that would be more ecologically relevant for sure.
Wow, but what you're writing is going to be, I mean, that's hard. But you've got all this journalism background, right? So you've got that, okay, the facts, man, but to get it over to, it's so hard to, it's like history and science, to get that to the general public to understand, to want to, I mean, it's necessary that we assimilate that information and, you know, so that there is, you know, conservation protection and all of those great things, but to get it out to the masses is a difficult thing to get them to be interested and then learn it and get into it. So that do you with all the work that you've done, is that part of that learning thing in journalism, is to, how do I get them to be interested without, with it's not being fake news as everybody keeps running around? See, that's the hard thing, what you're saying also with that book, you know, I love The Secret Life of Plants.
I understand why. I mean, same. If I didn't know the background, I would feel really warm towards it. But yeah, I mean, that's threading that needle of like not sort of succumbing to being too unscientific while also like leaving room for a sense of wonder and also acknowledging the many traditions of knowledge that exist outside of the sciences that do acknowledge and have always acknowledged plants as sentient beings and persons, so to speak. I mean, being in Hawaii has been a really incredibly instructive thing in that sense, because everyone I've spoken to, Hawaiian or not, incorporate Hawaiian practices when doing their research, and when, you know, every time I've walked into a research site in a forest here with a researcher, before we walk in, they sing a oli, which is a, as far as I have learned so far, a sort of a chant that incorporates elements of the landscape and lots of different layered meanings to sort of ask permission to come in and acknowledge that they need to give something back for taking data. And, you know, so there's a lot of like recognition of plant life as, you know, people here seem to often use personal pronouns for plants. That they're not it. It's they or he or she or, absolutely. There's a lot
Male and female plants. I don't know that you could always tell when you buy a couple plants from the nursery or something, oh, this is a male and that's female, until something happens reproductively. Like, then you go, oh, that's a boy and that's a girl. Then you have to change your names, you know?
Totally. Or not. Well, a lot of plants also just switch their gender halfway through. See, you know, they alternate.
Really?
Yeah. So it's like, I'm tired of being this. I want to try that side now.
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, this is,
maybe that's a survival thing, to make sure the plant can procreate and carry on no matter what.
Yeah, especially in populations where there's very few of them left, like here. If you have, a botanist on Kauai is someone who often has to hand pollinate very rare plants. And when it is separate male and females, they're basically doomed. Like, you'd have to carry pollen from maybe the other side of the island to the last remaining. From the last remaining male to the last remaining female. So it's much more in the interest of the plant to do both.
That's why we have to take care of our hummingbirds and our bees and, you know, our pollinators are so important to our own. If we want food down the road, we need to stop all that insecticide stuff.
When we look at what's going on in Oregon and California with all the wildfires and, you know, we cover the sequoias, like it's an area, we were back there again this year and, just looking, learning about fire management and you thinking about how, now the fires are so much hotter. I wonder if their production, fire used to be part of the natural way of even getting the seeds to open up. I wonder now with these wildfires being so hot, if it just scorches the seed and just burns them. You know, I wonder about these natural changes. Well, they're not all natural. If that's going to affect the propagation of these.
I'm sure. I mean, I wish I knew more about fire ecology. It's becoming more and more of a relevant field. Even here, I mean, there are botanists or people who work for the national park here who have been sent to California now to do fire ecology there in the midst of the fire. I guess when you reach a certain level of fire crisis, like anyone who knows what they're doing gets flown to these fires. It's a really scary thing to watch. I recently moved from Brooklyn to Washington State and it's my first time. I grew up in the East Coast, first time experiencing like smoke days and, being aware of like, you can't take that highway because there's a fire on it. Very new to me, but really horrifying.
You've got volcano stuff going on out there too. Like Mount Rainier. Have you been to Mount Rainier yet?
I have not.
It is pure magic. I mean, I get giddy about plants, like really like stupid giddy, and Mount Rainier, like they say, oh, you're in paradise. Like, and literally there's the biodiversity of wildflowers are just,
it's amazing.
You think about, it's volcanic again, and you think about just the dramatic season changes that they go through up there. Sure. And then this beauty that comes out of it, how did that happen? In Hawaii, when you think about the volcanoes erupting and then plant life coming after that, and we think about fire ecology, I want to call it lava ecology.
Definitely.
There's like a whole other thing going on. So while you were there, I mean, you were there for a month. So it seems like I was wondering about that, about during COVID, everything's been kind of different. Some artists have been able to go and do workshops and programs. I don't know if you got to do that, but I'm glad to hear that you did get to meet some researchers. Was that what your residency was like most of the time? Did you get a chance to write, or are you really out in the field most of the time?
Oh, definitely got a chance to write. The COVID situation here is very bad. I was actually surprised I was still able to come here.
Wow.
So they're at the worst they've ever been.
Yeah,
definitely.
No,
I'm glad. But so it was just outdoor walks with researchers at most, and everyone's very careful here. Very different situation than like, let's say New York, which looks like it's totally open. This is like very different here. So no public programs, unfortunately, but it's been mostly taking incredible hikes and talking to researchers and also trying to write. I mean, it's wonderful to be, you have this experience all the time. If you're moving around, like your home environment can be the best thing in the world, but if you're seeing the same thing over and over again, it's really hard to have inspiration and new thoughts and feel aware, like my sense of awareness of things and the sense that I'm constantly learning things and I'm in a new environment as opposed to my home environment is so stark, and it definitely is so good for writing. I mean, I at first when I realized residencies as a concept existed, which was honestly not that long ago, I was like, this is wild. This is the one area in our society that like values creative time, literally values it. Like there's funding for it, there's space for it. There's this understanding that you need separateness from your home and also aloneness and also amazing environments to do the best work you can do. I mean, there's nothing else in society that thinks that way about art.
You're really right.
It's really interesting because you have to open your mind to different ways of looking at things. For example, I had an art professor who made us crawl on our hands and knees through a garden instead of walking. And then she turned around, okay, you walk through as a normal person, then you crawl through and you see things that you didn't see before. Mm-hmm. If you look up when you're on your hands and knees, you see a whole bunch of insects that are under the leaves, not on top. And when you're walking, now you see things that are on top of the leaves. And then she's like, okay, now walk up. And then she had us all hold the rope and walk looking up. So we wouldn't bump into things so that you could see what was going on above you, so that you got more of an experience of everything that the place had to offer. So it's kind of a thing, you know, like, you know, a lot of times I just want to get my hands and knees because there's so much going on.
Thing.
I know.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be warthogs?
Yeah. And then it was be blindfolded so you could smell, you know, and taste things that you normally wouldn't taste, nothing that would kill you, so that you got this whole idea of what the world of, she used to do, like little itty bitty place pieces that make this huge world.
Observance.
Yeah, change of perspective. It's great.
That stimulates. I think what you say is really true about that stimulation, because I know we're in a different place all the time. And recently we were in Georgia, Peachtree City. There's lots of trees and lots of peaches. But where I was working, and we were on deadline for the magazine, and I write a lot of stuff in my head, and then you start to put it on paper and you're like, come on, talk to each other, hands, do it, brain, do that thing. But I just sat down early in the morning, looked out, and there's this forest, and I'm upstairs looking down this far, and I'm up by the treetops, and there's something about treetops that rocks. There's hawks, there's owls, there's deer coming through, and I look down and I'm like, all of a sudden I could just, there was like a flow of energy. And I wonder about that. And I think, you know, people always talk about, magical. It's inspiring, but I think it is about that newness that there's like the magic of life when you're in the right place. And I think what I've heard, you're in like the most amazing house too.
It's a pretty cool house. Yeah. It's beautiful. There's a lot of balconies and it's, you can see the ocean very far away, but it's there, and it's amazing. And I'm still on West Coast time, so I see the sunrise every day.
That's cool.
It's pretty magical. Yeah.
Yeah. What's up with this East Coast stuff? I'm used to 4 in the morning sunrise things from being in the desert. And I'm like, I'm up. Where are you?
That's so funny.
Like, that is dark
at 7 in the morning. Here it's like, the sunrise is around 6 and it goes down also around 6. And I think it does that pretty much all year because I'm not totally sure about this. I should check, but we're so near the equator, and it also comes up so fast and goes down so fast. Like sunset's like 2 seconds long. It's interesting. I must be geographically where we are, but it's a very jarring experience. Very different than what I'm used to.
In Kenya, the sunrise and sunset was, because it's on the equator, same time every single day, no matter what the season. It was kind of weird, you know. It's like, well, we should be setting our clocks to the equator somehow.
Yeah, totally.
So would you do another National Parks Arts Foundation residency?
Oh my God, yes. I really hope to.
All the other ones? Any of the other parks interest you, like Dry Tortugas?
All of them. Well, Dry Tortugas looks absolutely incredible. I know you have to go in a pair. It's so isolated that scares me a little bit. But my partner is also an environmental journalist, and so we've been thinking about applying as a pair.
Oh, that's so
cool. Should be very cool. All of them. I would love to go to the one at the national park on Maui, just to see another. I think what's amazing about being in Hawaii and having only gone to Kauai prior to this, Kauai is the oldest island geologically, and Hawaii, the big island where I am now, is the newest island. And it's still being formed because it's still on the volcanic hotspot. So all the islands were created on this spot and then moved down a chain, basically. So Kauai is the farthest away. It was on the spot last. And now this is, or first rather, and now this island's still being formed. So it's the geography, the like landscape is totally different. Some of the plants are very different. the feeling is different. Like everyone lives with lava here. Kauai, it's like a distant memory, like literally millions of years ago that they were volcanic. So it'd be amazing to see Maui, which is in between.
Oh, that would be good just to get that other balance. What about the desert Southwest? Are you looking at any of the plants in the deserts with what you're doing?
I haven't yet. I would absolutely love to. I'm hoping to do a cross-country trip in February and drive through New Mexico, Arizona, all of that.
Yeah. See, they got their
desert
Chaco.
Plants are amazing.
Yeah, they are. They're fascinating. Chaco, they got Chaco, and they've got Death Valley. In February, Death
That's
Valley
true.
Would be awesome too. Like,
that would be really cool.
We want to apply, but it's like it's so hard a full month, and then
we can't.
Tanya would know we applied, and we probably wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah,
you two enmeshed.
I know, but we do go to the parks as much as we can. As we travel, we've managed to do like Gettysburg, Chaco, and we did Fort Union. So we've managed to get out there, and it's. Interesting to me, the connection. I know you write about this a lot between the people, the history and the nature. So even when you're going to a park like Fort Union, that's very historic and about the different wars and the Apache wars and you know, the Santa Fe National, the Santa Fe Trail, you've got to realize the relationship with the people through the years, with the plants, with the animals, and how, you know, a lot of the animals have their migration routes. And so it's this whole, that's what's so cool about the parks to me is that you may be going for the history, but you're going to come out knowing nature, or you may be going for nature, but you need to know the history too.
Well, it's so connected,
you
know, the history is created by the natural surroundings.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, I really, it's something, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you have to learn how to handle the nature that where you're living or visiting through, and it makes you change in order to survive, which becomes history.
Definitely. Yeah. Something I really appreciate about this park and probably all the parks in Hawaii, all of the signs are both teaching you the species name and like things about the plant or that, you know, animal or whatever it may be, but they're also including the Hawaiian name and the use for that plant for Hawaiians.
Nice.
So there's a native club moss that in Hawaiian, the name means rat foot, I believe, or mouse foot. And, you know, and then there's this, cause it kind of looks like a paw. And then there's a whole description of how it was used for rheumatism used by Hawaiians.
Nice.
Isn't that weird when you go back to how all these, you know, historic uses for plants, like Native Americans have used this for soap or for this kind of illness. How did they just go, here, let's try and chew on that and see, you know, and hopefully we won't die. I mean, you got to be careful, like right now, for those watching versus listening, you'll see we've got berries behind us, and if I was just walking by, I'd be like, ooh, it looks really pretty and looks juicy and like a, you know, it looks like a pink blueberry in a way. I just would eat that, but you could end up like, you know, the dude in the bus in Denali eating the wrong plant. You know what I mean?
Totally.
So it's like that whole research, have you come across any writings of from people or any information on how they get to figure out what works and what doesn't?
I am not at all an expert on this, but I do know that, you know, cultures that were here thousands of years ago, I mean, if you have thousands of years to work on, to where you have to survive based on your environment and use your resources very carefully, and you also have all this time to be like really intimately aware of all of the plants around you, I'm sure a combination of things like watching what animals might eat or trial and error, honestly, there must have been so much, but it has produced, I mean, I'd say in any, you could probably look at any indigenous culture and see that they were intimately aware of like the uses of basically every, like almost every plant has a use for people. And I mean, I think that's oftentimes now also being confirmed by, you know, so to speak, Western science. There's a, you know, most of our pharmacological compounds come from plants, and oftentimes they're plants that were being already used by the population that had always been there, probably for a very similar thing, which is really amazing.
Like Ayurveda. Like Ayurveda, we're seeing more and more of that being talked about, you know, the different, you know, the different herbs that are used in cooking and just, you know, medicinal use and just even daily care, how Ayurveda, I mean, that was one of the most ancient forms of medicine back in the day, you know, I think with the very first of healing. And we see it now more in the West, more and more, which is exciting. I think it just opens the doors, and I'm seeing more of integrative health and the West and the East meeting on, okay, you know, we can look at what the ancient people did and not just scratch it off. You know, something came from somewhere. I know we were talking before you came on that, you know, it's like, what, bacteria is a good thing, you know, it's like, and here we are in our houses putting Clorox on everything, but you know, you know, it's kind of weird, that full circle. But tell everybody what those berries are.
They are, I wish I had the Hawaiian name in front of me. I don't remember it, but they are the native huckleberry relatives. So basically a huckleberry species floated on the ocean or came over on a bird's belly millions of years ago. And the seed managed to survive and managed to speciate, like create new species. And this is one of them. Those are edible. People make jams out of them. They are not that juicy, actually. Most interestingly, like the juiciest, sweetest fruits and everything are not going to be native to Hawaii because of just of the way that evolution worked here. Like it didn't maybe need to try that hard to get, you know, there wasn't that many birds that the birds didn't have that many options. They didn't have to try to be so sweet to outcompete other fruits. So that's why they're kind of, everything's milder in flavor. But yeah, it's a native huckleberry.
So this is interesting when you talk about like the, you know, the plants like, oh, this is my kin, so we don't need to compete for things. We're going to work together, that kind of, you know, science. And right now, you know, even in certain parks, you need to brush off your hiking boots and even watch what you're bringing in with your backpack because of invasive species. So we're looking at that, but something comes from somewhere. Maybe it came on a boat or a ship, or it was an ancient evolution. So sometimes I wonder, it's like, were the invasives now that we're pulling out, were they supposed to come out and take out those plants? I mean, is this like a whole other war, plant war, in
a
way?
That's one way to look at it. Yeah. I mean, it certainly is. I think, that's an interesting point. It's like, who has the right to be here? That said, the ones that arrived so long ago are like so specifically adapted to live in like this delicate balance in the environment here, whereas like there are plants that have been imported mostly as like ornamentals. There's this beautiful ginger plant that's all over the place called Kahili ginger. It came from the Himalayas. It's got beautiful yellow flowers, absolutely stunning plant, so aggressively invasive. It just goes in and takes out, it fills up the understory so that no other plant, it like chokes out all other plants, so nothing else grows. Basically, and all these little native plants that never had to deal with like rapidly growing, fast shading plants, like have no chance. And so actually one day when I was here, I went out with a volunteer group to cut Kahili ginger. And, you know, I thought it was such a beautiful plant, but your relationship changes to it so much when you realize it's like suppressing these plants
like
that
the murder
have plan. Like evolved in a very different way. Yeah, exactly. And so actually something I'd like to write about, you know, I'm also a freelance reporter, I'm still writing other stories besides this book, is the ways that there's a big conversation around how to ethically travel to Hawaii. I mean, the tourism industry here is huge, and there's been a lot of conversation, especially during COVID, like, is it ethical to come here? And probably not the best time to be a tourist in Hawaii, of course, but there's such a strong concept of, you know, you talked about these researchers going to the forest and like giving something back in order to take their data, like whether it's a chant or something. And that's just pervasive here, that you don't enter somewhere without permission. You don't take something without giving back. And tourists can come here and do some of this invasive species work. And it's very, very fun. And like, I'd love to write about how they could get hooked up with these groups who do this, because it's such a satisfying feeling realizing you can, like, we cleared, it was a group of like 8 people, and we went out for maybe 3 hours, and we cleared a really huge area of Kahili ginger, just lopping it off with clippers. Very satisfying to cut, very easy. And in the, underneath, you could see baby native plants that were like waiting.
They're like, thank you, I got sunshine. That's
sunlight.
Such a
And then they took us to a different forest where they had been doing this ginger cutting for a long time, and it was totally different, and you saw the native plants coming back. So I think that's awesome. Something people would love to do if they have the opportunity, and it feels really good to do.
That's awesome.
I think I mean, we've done a lot. That. I mean, majority of our life is like awareness and doing. And when you do travel and get involved versus the typical, you can have your typical things that you want to do, but when you give back, you really get to, you got to get dirt under your fingernails. You really do, because you start to understand. It's like even like how we travel with pet sitting or whatever. You are actually in someone's garden and you're weeding or taking out things, and you're like, I didn't even know this plant existed. Now you've got this whole other level of understanding. And there is a whole movement called transformative travel that is going on. And we just did an interview with Sherry Wyatt. She's a part of the Whidbey Camino Islands in Washington. And it's all coming out of Seattle, by the way. saying. And there's a trying to get people to travel. It's about responsible tourism, but it's beyond don't throw your... Stop. I mean, our tour started with a kid throwing a soda can and on the Ohinga Trail in Everglades, and it's sitting there amongst a bunch of gators. Now, who's going to get that? And the parent not telling the kid to
didn't do anything,
you know. So there's we still have those basics to learn, but I sometimes I think you do need to be the one cleaning up the cans to understand never to do it again. I'm not saying throw the kid in there with the gators, but you know. I just at that moment, I felt like it.
But, you know, I'm in two minds.
Sorry, you know, but if we have these volunteer, that is transformative. If we are actually doing, then we will understand our behaviors and be able to adjust accordingly, you know? And yeah, I think that's a whole, that's cool. Well, I can't wait. I've got you on Twitter. I know you do all on Twitter and Instagram, right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Definitely. Well, mostly just Twitter.
Us too. So I'm going to be watching. I can't wait to keep following what you're doing and anything you do with NPAF. Are you doing any specific stories from your experience?
Well, mostly this experience will end up in the book, I imagine. Cool. But also hopefully stories. We'll see.
Awesome.
We'll see what
awesome. Awesome. Well, listen, please come back when your book is out. I can't wait to read it.
That's totally.
I geek out on that stuff. I love it. But, you know, I'm still now bummed about The Secret Life of Plants because I love that book. It's one of the only books I kept in our storage unit was that book. Aww. It's like my favorite. We've got a few, you know, that are experts on the blend. But
well, it made people love plants, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's
well, what got me is about the meditation over the leaves and how the plant could survive if it had that connectivity. So are you going to tell me that that's don't
it is
that
not
face?
Replicable. They were unable to replicate that.
So I need to stop talking,
you know, there's
about
a world there's a world in which like years from now we may have technology that's able to create a study that would actually be able to measure that.
I think it's an open your mind book.
Yeah.
So maybe there was a little fibbing, a little exaggeration here and there by the authors who just wanted us to open our mind a little bit and not think that we should be destroying everything we touch.
Hey.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. And that's a good thing.
Well, I'm glad you're doing a follow-up on this. This is awesome. Everyone, keep up with Zoe. She is zoeschlanger.com. And also for the National Parks Arts Foundation, they totally rock. Go to nationalparksartsfoundation.org. I should just say .org. They rock, you know. But also keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. Again, we interview artists every first Friday, and our shows air Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. Thank you so much, Zoe.
Thank you.
It's great to talk to you guys.
You too.